Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 314, we are back with a preview of the October 2021 edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician is available in print and online for free at retinalphysician.com. And we discuss this issue, which goes through diabetic retinopathy. First, we discuss some of the latest drugs and trials out for diabetic retinopathy, ranging from phase 3 to phase 1 trials. We then discuss the role of laser for diabetic retinopathy, with special focus on focal laser. End with the discussion of crunch, the crunch effect and anti-VEGF and tractional retinal detachments in diabetic retinopathy, and a brief financial freedom discussion at the end. Remember, you can claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes by clicking on the link in the episode description. That will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website, where you can claim CME credits for this podcast and many other podcast episodes. You can also find a list of financial disclosures in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with another episode of Retinal Physician Preview. This one's looking at October 2021 issue, which focuses on diabetic retinopathy. I'm joined for this by two friends and colleagues, first in alphabetical order, Dr. Akshay Thomas, who's joining us from Tennessee Retina. Akshay, welcome back.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks for having me.
And then we have Dr. Priya Vakharia, who's joining us from Tampa, Florida. Priya, welcome.
Hello, everyone.
So we're not going to summarize these in great detail. You can read all these articles online at retinalphysician.com, but we're going to use them as jumping off points for discussion. So the first article is about current clinical trials in diabetic macular edema. This is by Tom Jula and Raj Maturi. And again, they just kind of go in. The big trials that we already know about that are out would be your RISE RIDE, Vivid Vista. And then we have, you know, the Protocol T, Protocol S, and some of the DRCR trials. So what are the newer kind of trials looking at, right? So they talk a little bit about Adverum and their intravitreal gene therapy for DME. One thing that was notable from that, and it was the INFINITY trial, and we can talk a little bit about that, is there was this serious adverse reaction of hypotony in an eye that resulted in them unmasking the trial. And this patient had hypotony that was, you know, so refractory to treatment that eventually in July of this year, they suspended the development of this drug for DME. Brolucizumab is currently in trials as well, and they talk a little about Kite and Kestrel. The results were just published in Uretina, but there's still some issues that have been potentially raised with vascular occlusion and inflammation. And we can reference that a little bit. We got our resident uveitis expert, Akshay Thomas, here to talk about that. Port delivery system, again, we talked about. They have the Pagoda trial that's ongoing for PDS for ranibizumab. We've heard a lot about Archway for and neurovascular AMD, but we have Pagoda. And then we have Kodiak Sciences. Kodiak is looking at durability of their molecule, KSI-301, and this is the GLEAM and GLIMMER trial. So I'm already starting to lose myself in acronyms. and you know, then there's other things, right? So then there's things like Graybug with sunitinib. There's tyrosine kinase inhibition there, and Opthea, which is blocking more than VEGF-A, but more VEGF-C and VEGF-D, OPT-302. And then finally, you have kind of your other pathways, TIE2, anti-integrin, and plasma kallikrein. All of these are kind of in earlier trials, phase 2 for kallikrein. Ang-2, phase 3 is out, in at least with early results in December 2020. And we're going to hear more about faricimab from Roche and Genentech. And then anti-integrins, you're talking about, you know, your Luminate, you're talking about Oxurion and Acutera Therapeutics, where they're still kind of early trials in phase 1, phase 2. But so to kind of bring this all back, and Priya, I'll let you jump off. So the big ones that seem to be on the horizon, right, would be port delivery, potentially, faricimab, potentially, brolucizumab, potentially, and then you're talking about KSI-301. Of these, I mean, so we've talked a little bit about these all for AMD, and it's no surprise that these all have been evaluated for DME now too. So does the conversation for any of these change when you think about DME versus AMD? So like, are you more inclined in DME to value certain attributes of a treatment modality versus AMD?
I think in DME, I think the patient populations are very different in DME and AMD. at least anecdotally in my experience, AMD patients seem to be more compliant, whereas DME patients are a working population oftentimes and less compliant. So I do think I really value a duration of treatment and durability of treatment in DME patients. But honestly, I also value that in our AMD patients who perhaps don't have an easy time getting into the office. But I think that a treatment that provides a long-lasting effect is very important in DME in these working patients. And I think that's why people are looking forward to a lot of these other treatments to see if any of these other treatments give us an increased durability of effect.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And actually, now looking at different options in terms of durability, what's kind of your preference, right? We're going to put all our disclosures at the beginning, and I'm sure we all have our biases here or there, but like when you talk about this, when you talk about a port and a diabetic versus a molecule that lasts a little longer, and we got three options there. You have faricimab and brolucizumab and KSI. How do you kind of weigh different things in these patients?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things. Obviously there's durability and efficacy, and I think also cost, right? I mean, there's got to be, a way to, we'll have to see what insurers and everything else allow for us to do. They might be dictating our treatment algorithm more than we want. But in my own personal practice, it obviously first, number one is efficacy, and second would be durability. And honestly, third would be cost. So I think kind of going back to what Priya said, I think for our diabetics, the one additional thing I'd bring up is, obviously having like a bispecific molecule like faricimab, something that potentially gives us some additional, vascular stability, which we think is probably hopefully going to turn out to be important in our diabetics, maybe fill a gap that we currently fill with steroids, and just kind of offer like a one-stop shop, one sort of option for them rather than mixing VEGF with steroids is certainly very alluring. I think when it comes to PDS, we're just going to have to wait and see. If faricimab ends up we're able to use it in a port, I think, and it ends up panning out to be as good as it appears to be in the trials and as safe as it's been in the trials, I think that'd be a very attractive option for our diabetics and our AMD patients as well.
Yeah, I'm curious, Priya, port, like people argue in older patients, maybe you're less concerned about long-term complications in 10 or 20 or 30 years, but then you have the concerns maybe the conjunctiva is not as healthy and you might have issues with erosion. Diabetic patients, they're younger, generally the conjunctiva is healthier, but then you also, again, there is an association between diabetic retinopathy and mortality, but you're also assuming you take a 40-year-old diabetic and you put a port in them, they're going to probably live a few decades with that port. Does that make, so I don't know where I feel on this. I have to think about it, but like, does that make you more or less inclined just given the status? Are you like, oh, good conj, better candidate? Or you're like, oh, well, this is going to be a long time. This thing has to stay there and not cause problems.
I mean, I think in general, if you look at the history of ophthalmology, we have devices that stay in the eye and for the most part, knock on wood, most of them don't cause a lot of problems with endophthalmitis or erosion over time. I know that's the big concern here. So I think for me, one is I think a younger patient with a better conjunctiva is going to be number one, because if at the time of surgery, things don't look good, I can't imagine it would look good 5 or 10 years down the road. And so I think that's important, but I also think we're going to not know exactly who needs a PDS and who might get faricimab or who might just get, stable anti-VEGF Q4 treatment. And so I think a lot of this is going to be dependent on the patient and how compliant they are with their visits. But I think for me, I would, if it looks good at the time of surgery, I think I would probably consider putting it in a younger patient.
Actually, what are your thoughts on the inflammation issues, right? So we can talk a little about brolucizumab. We don't want to beat a dead horse, but we just saw Kite Kestrel data in the last couple of weeks. We're recording this September 23rd, and that was presented at URetina. And so they still had some incidence of this in Kite and Kestrel. It didn't completely disappear. Was it higher in these patients? It was not. They showed that these patients, you may be concerned they're more hypercoagulable. Maybe they get more vascular occlusion. That did not happen. But it still happened in about the same incidence that you saw in Hawk and Harrier, that in what we're talking about is IOI with RAO and vision loss. And then what about Adverum, right? So we didn't get that many, we don't have that many details on that because we just got some press releases that it got suspended. But I feel like this is a concern as a uveitis person. I'm curious in your thoughts. I feel like this concern, we never saw this concern with, or talked about this concern much with bevacizumab and ranibizumab and aflibercept. But now with brolucizumab, and then we saw with abicipar, and now we're seeing with Adverum, like this is, the eye actually doesn't necessarily love everything that we inject into it and reacts poorly in some instances. So like, so what are your thoughts on this? Like, why are we seeing a greater incidence of this? And how do you kind of balance that risk, right, when you're talking about different options?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. One, I suspect the more, you know, potent the molecule, the more likely we are to see some sort of inflammatory response. And I think that's definitely true with brolucizumab. One thing I think that a lot of these trials have brought up, and I've probably mentioned this before, Jay, is that a lot of our clinical trials are just not well designed to detect inflammation. I mean, I'd love to say that we are truly capturing, you know, all mild cases of vitritis and iritis and every little bit of retinal vasculitis in these trials. But the reality is, unless we have wide field FAs and, you know, and imaging, you know, side by side, visit over visit, we're likely missing things. And that's probably why post-marketing data is higher than clinical trial data. And I think that's my big concern with a lot of the molecules that we have, you know, coming out, or if we're going to see a spike compared to the clinical trials in general. With the one thing you mentioned, abicipar, the one thing with abicipar that I thought was interesting, and this is obviously with the AMD data, is that, you know, they mentioned like a 15% inflammation rate in the first year. But in the 2 year data, it was almost equal to ranibizumab, right? So I think that details like that are actually very important, because if you're able to identify your at-risk patients and say that if this patient's going to get an inflammatory response, it's going to happen, you know, within the first 6 months, and you're able to kind of breathe a little easy and use it, there's probably going to be more uptake in the community rather than a, hey, this could happen at any point of time. You need to keep your eyes open at all times, you know, whether it's they're 3 years into treatment or on their second injection. I think it's a very hard pill for us to swallow as retina specialists.
You know, not all inflammation is created equally either, right? So like, this is the interesting thing is like if you actually go back and look, there was an incidence of inflammation in the original ranibizumab and bevacizumab in aflibercept trials, but no one really talked about it because it wasn't associated with any sort of negative outcome. And then you have brolucizumab data, real world data, trial data. And it's like, oh, some of these patients lose vision. And I'm not saying we're overcalling it, because we obviously want to prioritize safety, especially now that we're talking about, hey, these options are not necessarily more efficacious, but they're just more durable for the most part. Yeah. You don't want to take somebody who could have been fine with standard therapy and blind them with your treatment. At the same time, I wonder if for good reason, even though we're not good at quantifying inflammation in trials, if we're being more diligent about it than we were before. Like, how many of us inject our patients with ranibizumab or bevacizumab or an aflibercept and then check them for cell, you know, on each visit and are looking to see? Should we? Probably not, because it's not affecting their final outcome, at least what we can see and think. But in a trial now, I feel like if you're abicipar or faricimab or any sort of new drug, sunitinib, whatever, I feel like there's a bigger burden of proof now where you have to really quantify these things, because everyone's looking for these kind of markers when you show it to the FDA or show it on a slide. So it's interesting. I wonder if you ported, like we did a time trial and ported those drugs to today and put them through trials, like would the incidence be a lot higher than what was reported?
I think it's a fair point, and we just don't know. I'm part of the team doing like a regrade of some of the POC data, and I can't really comment too much on the imaging, but I suspect that if we were to go back and look, you know, at their OCT images, you know, from some of our aflibercept studies and ranibizumab studies, we'll probably notice like some vitreous cells floating around that we then weren't appreciated clinically. So I think it's entirely plausible.
So let's shift gears to this next paper. We're going to talk a little bit about the current role of laser therapy in the management of diabetic retinopathy. This is by Mansour and Browning. And they mostly focus on, you know, they talk about PDR, but they really focus a lot on DME too. And those are very different sort of things, right? PRP, I don't think we need to beat a dead horse again, but we know that PRP reduces risk of complications in patients with high-risk post-op diabetic retinopathy. We utilize in other patients as well. Focal laser was the gold standard treatment prior to anti-VEGF. We can talk a little bit about where we think that role fits in today. And they talk about some of that older data. And then they talk about combo therapy, both for PDR with PRP and anti-VEGF. And again, I'll spend less time talking about that just because I think we've talked about that a lot on the podcast before. But again, the idea of focal laser, and where does focal laser kind of fit into our algorithm? So Priya, I'll let you start, and I'm gonna give you a little leading anecdote. So I remember when I was a fellow, we got invited to do some recorded CME talk. It was like a fellow faculty thing. We got paired up with the faculty. We woke up at like 5 a.m. during Academy, and they took us in some bus to some hotel. We were all very tired. They put makeup on all of us. It was, we took pictures of each other getting makeup. It was really awkward. Those photos and videos are somewhere in storage. And then they put us up on a panel, and it was Tony Joseph, who you know well, and I were put on a panel. And I remember on that panel was Dr. Jeff Heyer, who you trained with, and Dr. Diana Doe, who's at Stanford now. Jeff Heyer at that time, remember they asked him about focal laser, and this was during this thing. And he said, and I don't want to misquote him, if he's listening, he's changed his mind, that's fine. But remember at the time he said, he's like, I really don't see a role for focal laser in the treatment of DME in 2016. I'm dating myself, but this was 2016. And now we're in 2021. And I'm not an absolutist. So I will accept that there are probably some situations where focal laser should be employed. But I'm curious, as someone who trained with him, what are kind of your views on focal laser today? Like, do you use it? How often, like how many focals are you doing in a year? And what patients are you using it in?
So I maybe do 5 focal lasers, maybe 5 to 10 focal lasers a year, compared to, you know, the hundreds to thousands of injections we do for DME. So for me, I mean, I very much agree with Jeff Heyer, of course. You know, I don't see a huge role for focal laser, but I will say that there are a few patients who have these chronic exudative changes, and you get a fluorescein and you see these microaneurysms that you just know if you treat those, it's going to help their thickening, it's going to help their edema. And I have, you know, there's this one patient that I can think of distinctly in my mind who I focal lasered and she did fantastic. And so I do still think there is a role, but the problem is the majority of these patients aren't leaking from focal microaneurysms. The majority of them have this diffuse petaloid leakage or this diffuse pattern of leakage, or the microaneurysms are way too close to their fovea to feel comfortable doing laser. So I think my algorithm is always the same. I get a fluorescein on all of these patients and I look, and majority of them either are observation or anti-VEGF. And occasionally I'll have that select patient that I can do focal laser. And I think in the right patient, it's still a great, great technology.
Yeah. Yeah, I have some thoughts and I agree with you. Akshay, what about you? How many focal lasers have you done in the last 12 months?
Probably 2. and I'm thinking of the 2 patients. And I'd say that the patients I end up doing focal on are the ones that have a, you know, cluster of microaneurysms with a circumcentric ring of lipid, and that lipid is kind of encroaching on the fovea. And I don't think they don't have central DME, and I'm just trying to see if we can reduce that exudation so that lipid doesn't get there and we eliminate their need for anti-VEGF. Those are pretty much the only ones that I do focal on, but it's different with everyone in my practice. There are some that seem to have very good results doing focal and have been doing focal for a long time. I think even for them, their numbers are far fewer than they've been historically. But you know, even in training, I don't feel like we did a ton of focal. I feel like I did more micropulse than I did focal in training, to be honest with you. But yeah.
And micropulse is a whole different conversation we could get into, but we're going to avoid that today because it's a lot to discuss. So yeah, I mean, I feel like I trained before you guys, but I remember my residency, I probably did 20 focals as a resident or something. And now I feel that the residents barely do it. Like if they do one during the residency, it's like a heroic act of valor. And everyone's like, oh my God, you did a focal laser. Things really evolve. And I agree. I have done, again, for DME, the number of focal lasers I've done in the last 12 months has to be like 1. I do it for other indications like CSR and some other indications. You know, the thing I struggle with and obviously protocol V was very helpful for a lot of reasons, but I feel a lot of those patients, they're like, oh, this is a great focal laser candidate. Look at that pattern. They have edema that's ascending the fovea. Look at that pattern of microaneurysms. A lot of those patients have good vision. And so the thing that I struggle with, the protocol V kind of showed us like, well, yeah, you could do focal laser and probably the OCT will get better and the vision gets better. And you feel, and we feel like you prevented a problem down the line. But we actually don't have data that tells us that, right? Because if you look at protocol V, when they randomize those patients to injection versus focal versus just going, you know, for observation. Now, again, they did not separate for focal laser. Hey, your microaneurysms had to be, quote unquote, what we're talking about, good focal candidates. So again, you have a lot of mishmash in there. You have patients who probably shouldn't have gotten focal and patients who are what we call better candidates for focal. But you didn't see that visual acuity benefit long-term to giving them focal early, even though, again, when we do something and we see an effect from it, we attribute the causality. We're like, oh, okay, they kept good vision because I did this thing. In reality, you could have just watched them and they also could have been fine. Or you could have watched them. They could have gotten a little swollen in 6 months. You give them one shot and then they were fine after that. And they could have all ended up at the same good vision, right? So like, so I agree with both you. I mean, I think that the variability of human beings is such, there are patients who probably are good candidates for focal laser who I think the ideal candidate is just someone who just, they get anti-VEGF, but either doesn't last, it recurs, they're not getting durability. You switch agents, they're not getting durability. They have something that looks like it's amenable to focal. And a lot of times those patients, you supplement with some focal and you can sort of cut off the process. But I think it's pretty rare that any of us are jumping straight to it first line. I'm sure there are people out there who take 20/20 or 20/25 patients, they'll do focal. I just struggle with doing that now, given the data that's out there. But I don't, Priya, I don't know if you have thoughts on the idea of good vision patients who get focal.
I agree. I think the DRCR showed us that patients with good vision don't necessarily need to be treated. They do fine with just observation. And so I think, you know, I completely agree with Akshay. I think the best candidates for focal laser are those ones with exudates that you're worried are going to encroach the fovea. But beyond that, you know, I don't think anyone is faulted for observation in patients with good vision.
Akshay, final thoughts on laser?
I'm not sure if MicroPulse works, but we're not getting into that.
Okay. I don't know if MicroPulse works either. I'll leave it at that as well. So next article, tractional retinal detachment following anti-VEGF injections in proliferative diabetic retinopathy by Elad Moiseev and Anat Lowenstein. But really the subtitle is the word we all like to hear, that very onomatopoeia word. Retina specialists should be aware of this phenomenon known as crunch effect. Though we never hear this sound, we all call it the crunch phenomenon, right? So just to summarize, they talk about this idea of crunch, right? This is cases that it's been reported in pediatric conditions, ROP and COATS, and then adult conditions like EELs, and where you can get a tractional retinal detachment sudden onset within a few weeks of giving an anti-VEGF injection to someone with significant non-perfusion and proliferation. So the real question, first of all, so there's been some debate for, and I think most retina specialists now agree that crunch is a real thing, but there are people out there who still argue crunch may not be a real thing. But they talk about the incidence of crunch, the reported incidence of crunch as high as 18%, which seems really big, but that's a couple of series they cited there. And they say it's really, really difficult to estimate how often this happened. We'll get into reasons why that might be. And part of the issue is the natural history of TRDs is they tend to progress, right? So the question is the natural disease progression or is it from the injection? Well, you don't have a comparison a lot of times for that patient's exact eye, so it's hard to know. So they looked at some protocol DRCR network studies, and they found that patients who got anti-VEGF were less likely to develop TRDs or need vitrectomy, but they weren't statistically significant. But again, that does not isolate out crunch because we know that in general, most patients do better with anti-VEGF than not. So I'm going to ask Akshay you two questions. First of all, do you believe in crunch? If you do believe in it, how do you identify the patients in your mind who are higher risk for crunch? And because crunch sounds like the delicious sound of breakfast cereal, what is your favorite breakfast cereal? Because it makes me think about Captain Crunch, which I never really enjoyed, even though it sounded good in theory.
So I do believe in crunch. I'll just give a quick illustrated example. So for me, if I have a diabetic that doesn't have, you know, DME and they've got PDR and I know I'm going to be taking the operating room, they have a, you know, macularizing TRD, I'll usually still do some light PRP just to see if I can kind of close off some of the vasculature a little bit. And I'll still usually give them an anti-VEGF 3 to 5 days prior to surgery. And I'm thinking about a young type 1 diabetic who went through his PRP just fine. And three days before surgery, I gave him anti-VEGF and I went and I operated on him and he had developed like this tractional macular hole. Like it was just so much more traction than just a couple of days prior. For me, I don't like treating PDR with anti-VEGF monotherapy, period. I'll usually start with PRP and then followed with some anti-VEGF if necessary. But I'd say the ones that I'm concerned about are obviously any patients that have, you know, an extensive fibrosis along their arcades, kind of that ring pattern. I'd say also in my like type 1 diabetics, like just the ones that have you know, just kind of more formed vitreous where their, you know, highlight isn't lifted in the mid periphery. In my handful of cases of crunch, I feel like those have been the ones that have contracted or developed like TRDs, RRDs, right, with the tear right at the edge of like a little frond of NV. So those are the ones that I especially avoid anti-VEGF as a first treatment for PDR.
I'll forgive you not answering the cereal question because it has nothing to do with our conversation, but Priya, Priya, what about you? So crunch believer, how do you identify your, anything to add or different than what Akshay said in terms of identifying patients who are higher risk for crunch? And then the follow-up question we talk about is, so if you do think they're higher risk for crunch, Akshay gave you kind of his way he approaches it. What do you do?
So I do believe in crunch, but I believe that retina specialists are so afraid of crunch that sometimes they undertreat patients. Mm. And so, yes, I believe in crunch. I think crunch is real, and I agree giving anti-VEGF a few days before surgery is important. But I found at least, you know, that the fellows that I've trained are so paralyzed in fear of crunch that they will PRP and, you know, they're PRPing areas that don't need to be PRP'd, and they're just so afraid to give anti-VEGF. And I think that the benefits of anti-VEGF go beyond just regressing, you know, some peripheral areas of retinopathy. I think that retina specialists sometimes are so afraid of crunch that they're afraid to do anti-VEGF. And so for me, I agree with Akshay. Patients with fibrovascular proliferation around the arcades, I find if they have any traction anywhere close to the macula, near the arcades, anything like that, they're very high risk of progressing to a Macroff TRD or having this crunch phenomenon. And so I counsel them and I tell them, if you notice a change in vision, you need to let me know right away. And then if they come in and it happens, they're not as upset. But I've found that for the majority of patients, they actually do fine. So I'm not afraid to use anti-VEGF in patients. I just counsel them that it is a potential risk.
So, you know, I feel like I missed out because I feel like I got to college right around the time. I feel like there was a big boom in the early 2000s, late 90s in college towns, they would open these restaurants that were like dessert bars, but they were cereal bars, right? And you'd go and you can mix and match cereal, right? You guys are like, why is he talking about this? Well, because crunch makes you think of cereal, right? So they had these places you could go and you could get Froyo and cereal. All this stuff. I really like breakfast cereal, but it's really bad for you. So I don't really buy it. But then by the time I got to that point, all the ones that were at our school closed. And now no one cares because people are like, well, you could just buy cereal at the grocery store. But we'll come back to favorite cereal in a second. So I agree with everything you guys said about crunch. So Akshay, your point about peripheral or more peripheral NV is well taken. I mean, that's one of the big reasons sickle patients are much higher risk for developing combined detachments than diabetics. And then there are some diabetics who they get this mid-peripheral NV, and that's very scary because the retina tends to be thinner out there. One could argue those patients, whether or not you inject them, the natural history is more prone to tearing though too. Sure. I agree with you, Priya, that people are more scared of crunch than they should be, meaning most people overcall it. And that probably goes back to the Hippocratic Oath, and most people just don't like being causative for something bad. So when push comes to shove, most of us don't want to do something that makes the patient go blind. And you get into the psychology of the number needed to treat, like how many patients you need to not do therapy, but then they have a problem from maybe versus the one patient that you did something and it caused a big problem and you feel responsible for that. I think crunch can happen with PRP or anti-VEGF. I think there's different reasons for it. Obviously, I think if you laser too hot, especially on fibrosis, we all know that can cause microbreaks and cause tears and cause contracture. But I think even well-done PRP, I've had cases shown to me by colleagues or as a fellow by attendings where a lot of PRP was done all at once and the patient crunched. And then how do you know that's contraction just from regression of NV or not? You can't separate it out. But when the timing is so acute, right? So if it's a few weeks later, it's really hard to tell. But some of these cases, it's just a couple of days later, like full PRP was done and boom, they just contracted right away. That can happen, I think, with injection or laser. I think it's more likely with injection because the VEGF drop, what you're doing to the cytokines of the eye, is much more dramatic with an injection. But you can achieve that same level with a heavy laser. And so the patients also, I think, that are higher risk. So the orientation of the NV is helpful. If the NV is vertically oriented, where it's coming off the retina into the vitreous, I think that's less likely to crunch because as it's regressing, it's not pulling along the retina tangentially. So if you get these vessels, and that's your mid-peripheral point you had, actually, if you have these vessels that kind of fimbriate out and they're kind of latched onto the retina, those are the ones that tend to tear and pull back. I think combined detachments are that are rapid are really the biggest bellwether of crunch. Those are the ones that's really hard to say, oh, that could would have just happened anyway. And so what do you do? I mean, you guys all reference what you do. I mean, those are the rare patients. I remember a couple of my things in fellowship taught me this. Very light laser, start with very small patches and maybe do a fifth or sixth of a PRP, 200, 300 spots, and just slowly add over time. Just be really gentle with those eyes. With the ultimate goal, and to the final point, I think the patients also, patients rarely get crunch when they already have kind of mature, pretty well filled in PRP, and then you inject them. And I don't know if it's from the laser doing something mechanically. I tend to believe it's more that your resting VEGF level is not as high in those eyes. You're not dropping it as dramatically. But yeah, those are the patients. If a resident or fellow brings to me and they show me a picture and they're like, it's full PRP and there's just some NV and they're like, I'm worried about crunch. I'm like, we're none of us are perfect. I'm like, that's probably not going to happen here. This patient probably would benefit a lot from injections. This is at a point where it's actually a little safer in a way to inject this eye. The highest risk eye we've all talked about is no PRP, nothing's been done, very, very vascular. If it was ROP, you would call it a plus disease. We don't use that term for PDR, but we have some of these PDR patients, you look and they're very, very, very vascular.
Right, right.
Yeah. Actually, any other points about crunch?
No, I mean, I think the other thing, obviously, to Priya's point, is that, you know, we're not treating patients with PDR in isolation, right? The majority of them also have, you know, some DME, and so we're going to need to treat that in some way, shape, or form. And so I certainly think it's people shouldn't be, you know, super afraid of using anti-VEGF, but at least acknowledge that this is a potential and counsel patients about it.
Priya, final thoughts? Anything about crunch or cereal?
Oh, yeah. My favorite cereal is Crave. It is the most delicious, unhealthy thing. You know, it makes me sad that you say that cereal healthy? Is unhealthy. No, Crave is so unhealthy.
Oh,
Crave,
okay. I have to Google it. It sounds healthy. So doesn't sound unhealthy. Doesn't have cookies or chocolate or cocoa or Reese's.
It is really terrible for you. It is really bad. And it makes me sad that you say cereal is unhealthy because I love cereal.
I love cereal too, but I'm at a stage in my life for most of the last decade and a half where mostly it's like granola or like it, which is not really that healthy either, but it's like healthier. But I'm talking about, so like breakfast cereal as a kid, I think Cocoa Krispies are really good until they get soggy, but there's two types of cereal. There's a cereal that's good when you pour the milk in it and you eat it and it tastes great right away. Then there's a cereal where you have to leave it for a little bit and then it's really good, right? But then some cereals don't taste good later. So like Cocoa Krispies is like first class. Like if you get it right away, it's crunchy, it's great. Cookie Crisp, not good when you pour milk over it first, but give it like 2-3 minutes. You guys not liking my, I really want to do a spinoff cereal podcast. As you can tell. Give it like 2-3 minutes and it's so good. All right, I digress. Last article we're going to cover is about finances. We're not going to belabor this either. Chirag Shah and I were invited to write a quick Q&A about financial planning. We had this book that was released, Financial Freedom RX, on Amazon and Slack. It's done really well, thanks to people who have bought it and sent it to their friends and, you know, given it as gifts to medical students, things. It's. I think, you know, we're speaking humbly, but we think it's a good guide to kind of get you started in terms of thinking how to approach your finances. You guys are both attendings who are wizard experts at this point at managing life and managing your money. But actually, you still haven't told us what your favorite cereal is, but you don't have to. But A, did you learn?
Cinnamon Toast Crunch. I'll just come and say it.
That's really good. That's first class. That's good before it gets soggy. Good when it's crunchy.
Gotta true. Be crunchy. Yeah. Yes, that's true.
Okay. But the milk is really good afterward. All right. So my question is, A, and you won't hurt my feelings, did you learn anything from this Q&A? And it's hard to answer anything really specifically in the Q&A, but bigger, more useful for the listeners is B, what are kind of the lessons, if you had to pass on a pearl you've learned in your experience now, a couple of years as an attending, anything you didn't know that you're like, ooh, I wish I had known that earlier, anything you'd want listeners who are out there who are just starting or in training to know that you're like, I really wish someone had told me that before I started.
Yeah. First off, I'll say that I really enjoy the Q&A. It reinforced, at least I was like, oh, I think I'm doing some things correctly, according to Jay and Chirag, at least. The second thing is that, you know, I think that the point that you guys made about you know, continuing to live like a trainee in your first couple years as an attending is important. But I mean, it's not like you're like really like slumming it and just, you know, having like stale cereal milk. I mean, you know, I feel like as a resident, you know, I live substantially better than I did as a medical student. And it wasn't really, you know, our needs and expenses didn't really change substantially during my first couple of years in practice. And so I think it's entirely plausible to do that. I think, as you've mentioned, the number of years that you have, you know, your investments in the market, that's one thing we all have, well, hopefully we all have, is the amount of time we can have our money in the market, right? So the sooner you're able to invest, even small amounts, it pays off in leaps and bounds over 30 years.
Priya, how about you? What have you learned as an attending the last couple of years?
First I want to applaud you and Chirag for putting this out there. I think that there are not a lot of physicians who are aware of financial planning and who take the steps to achieve financial independence. I think the biggest thing that I've learned is you cannot be afraid of investing or learning about this. You know, as you sometimes think, okay, when I become an attending, I'm going to know everything. And at that point, life is going to be great. And, you know, life is going to be smooth sailing, but the learning never stops. And it's not just learning about retina. You know, when you become an attending and you're sitting there in between patients, you have nothing to do, listen to a podcast, read a book, do something like that. And I think that's the biggest thing, is that most of us as physicians, our biggest mistake is that we just don't invest, or we don't get involved, or we don't think about these things. And I think you guys said it perfectly in your Q&A that the biggest mistake by physicians is inaction. And so the biggest thing that I've learned is to just try to read up a little bit. And we all have different levels of risk tolerance. So I have a very low risk tolerance, whereas my husband has a very high risk tolerance. And so, you know, it's important to know what your personal level of risk tolerance is, but don't be afraid of investing some money and broadening your horizons.
That's really good advice. I will say, we were just talking before the podcast about buying a house and all that stuff. Being an adult is hard, right? Adulting is not easy. It's complicated and it gets more complicated. And honestly, in some ways, even though what we do is complicated in some ways, it's almost easier to just work and not think about all this stuff. And you got to fight that tendency, because it's really easy to just go to work and do your thing and inject and look at OCTs. And then, because all this other stuff is not the stuff you were inclined to like. Otherwise, you would have pursued a different field. You would have pursued a financially oriented field. We kind of gravitated towards what we like to do. So we do work, and work is work, but we like it. And then there's the stuff you don't really necessarily like, but you got to understand a little bit of it, which is like, for me, the stuff that I don't enjoy, which I never fully understand, but I keep on learning, is like real estate and mortgages and property value and square footage and how big is a square foot. I know it's a foot by a foot, but like, to think about it. So Financial Freedom RX is still on sale. If you want to get a 25% discount code, just email me directly. I can get it for anyone listening. So final thoughts. So Crave, I Googled it as promised. First of all, it's spelled with a K. It's not healthy. I was completely wrong. It was original slogan was "Here Chalky Chalky" or "It's Time to Melt." And then Google's great, because it gives you, people also ask the common questions people ask about Crave. So the first question is Crave cereal discontinued? Yes, it is. Is Crave cereal healthy? Although the cereal is marketed as having good source of fiber, maybe whole grain, it turns out this breakfast cereal isn't even remotely healthy. And then it also shows up as a question in "What's the worst cereal for you?" It didn't make the list, but it was up there. Honey Smacks, which are gross, was number one on that list.
Is that right? Wow.
Well, you know, I grew up with four siblings, and our parents didn't let us buy really unhealthy cereal, especially because my mom was a pediatrician, right? So we didn't buy unhealthy cereal. I just like talking about it. But we used to buy the small boxes, you know, that you could get the single serving mm-hmm. boxes.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't sell single serving boxes of all these cereals, right? So what we would do is they'd sell like that 12-pack variety pack, right? Where you get all these different cereals, but we really were buying it for like the Cocoa Krispies, because that was the high demand item. And there'd be one in that 12-pack, but then you'd end up with all this other stuff that you didn't really want. And so our cupboard became like this dumping ground for Honey Smacks, because no one, Apple Jacks, and like these cereals that get thrown in there and no one would ever.
Cheerios.
Like regular Cheerios with no flavor, or Honey Nut?
I would say the regular Cheerios
were
relegated to the graveyard.
I think dad would eat them because he thought they were healthy-ish. Pops, no one would eat. Pops are actually good, but they're very processed. I'm not really sure what they're made of. But anyway, this has nothing to do. Well, actually, this has a lot to do with diabetes. Don't eat cereal. It may result in diabetic retinopathy. I tied that full circle without intending to. All right. Thank you guys for joining. Thanks for going a little bit over with me. Thanks for indulging random conversation about cereal, but also talking a lot about diabetes and then financial planning. Priya and Akshay, great talking to you guys. I'll see you guys soon.
Thanks, Jay. Bye, guys. Take care, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Drs. Vakaria and Thomas for joining me. Remember, you can find all 314 episodes, including this one, on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. There are 314 episodes. They are searchable and sorted by category. You can also get updates on the latest episodes by subscribing to our mailing list on the website or by finding us in your mobile device in the Apple Podcast and Android Podcast app. We're also on Amazon Podcast app if you prefer to use that as well. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can contact us in multiple ways. You can use our social media pages or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Again, thanks as always to our team that includes Drs. Mike Benincasa, Louis Kai, and Angela Ching. They do all the work behind the scenes, producing these episodes, releasing the social media, and really, this would not be possible without everything they put into this. So thank you, all three of you, for what you do. Thank you, listeners, for listening. Thank you for taking care of patients every day. Thank you for inspiring the conversations we have each week on this show. And thanks again for, you know, humoring our little discussion about breakfast cereal that we squeezed in there. And we'd love to hear more about diabetic retinopathy or breakfast cereal on our Twitter page, so at Retina Podcast. This is Jay Schreeder signing off. Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.